The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Can y'all hear me?
Louder.
Louder. So did y'all know there was a talk on superheroes that's happening at the same time as this? Yeah, this is actually a companion talk. It's a talk about supervillains. What to do about the police? So in this talk, I want to make a few points about how I think we should think about the police, how we should argue to others to think about the police, and what this means for our organizing. I'm not necessarily going to make the case that they behave in bad ways, because I assume that people here have that understanding, but what socialists should say about the institution. So there's a couple points I want to try to make. The first is that understanding the question of the police means seeing that the police are a product of capitalism and class society, and their entire purpose and function in society is to serve as an armed force of repression in order to maintain the sort of fucked up order in this vastly unequal society. In class society, racism is one of the primary tools with which they divide each to conquer all, and thus the primacy of racism, especially but not exclusively anti-black racism, is cooked into the very fabric of policing, and so it can't be separated from it any more than you could separate sugar from a cake after it's been baked. The sugar's a bad metaphor because it's tasty. Understanding the role of the police also means we have to sort of get rid of and completely disregard the conventional explanations and justifications for the police, and that is that they're about fighting crime. Like, that's completely ridiculous. Rather, I think we should see that cops play no useful role in our society to everyone that is not the ruling class millionaires and billionaires. Therefore, our goal should be ending them as an institution, along with their courts and prisons. The whole thing. That's a good start. You know? The goal of abolishing the police, though, is a giant task. And I think understanding how useful they are to the rulers to maintain their order means that we can't underestimate how the challenge to rid our world of cops is connected to the challenge of ridding our world of capitalism. We're not going to be able to sort of trick or convince the ruling class to get rid of this thing that they have. And so though while abolishing the police is a giant task, and it's the final goal, we still, of course, fight for reforms today. We don't just walk around saying, abolish the police. But I think how we understand the police and the need for them to end has ramifications on the kinds of reforms that we fight for and the way that we fight. Again, informed on the understanding of the nature and function of police and racist class society. I want to start a little bit talking about the origin of the police and the history. That's important stuff for folks to know. The police are a fairly modern institution. They were developed and all came into being during the course of a few decades that corresponds with the development of the large urban city from around 1820 to 1850. It was a period of time in which they all came into being. As capitalism developed large industry, there was a rapid population growth in the urban centers, with large numbers of displaced people forced to move to the cities to look for work. Cities before were largely populated by tradesmen and people in skilled craft guilds, but they became very quickly home to large numbers of people who were forced to then work in workshops, then factories, then large industries to survive and make their needs met. As people flooded into the cities, the people who owned the factories and the wealth found that they were then dwarfed in number. They were surrounded by whole large categories of people who basically had nothing, and these people sitting here who sort of owned everything that were forcing these people to engage in work in order to survive. This is a volatile situation for the ruling class and presented a large challenge to the owning class, the people who owned the factories and the wealth. So during these decades of the early city, there were numerous uprisings, rebellions, and strikes by what the elites would call the dangerous class, which was white workers, immigrants, enslaved African people, as well as free blacks. 70% of America's cities with populations over 20,000 saw major disorders in the first half of the 19th century. And the threat of slave rebellion haunted both the slaveocracy in the South and also even earlier in the North as well. In 1741, there was an attempted insurrection in New York City that was organized by enslaved Africans, immigrant dock workers, and poor whites, in which they almost burned the city to the ground. So there was a real threat that the ruling class was worried about in the South and the North. The early formation of capitalism and the consolidation, the bringing of all these peoples as new class of workers into the city, were a very violent and chaotic process, and that violence and chaos threatened the ruling class. So while Marx says all history is the history of class struggle, we have to understand that cops are the intervention on the ruling class side of that struggle. Before then, there was no such thing as the police as such. They didn't exist. They did exist courts of law and people that were called constables, a small group of people who were officials, who were representatives of the court. They would go and they could serve arrest warrants and other papers of the court, but they weren't standing bodies of armed men. They didn't patrol the streets, and they didn't have the power to sort of arrest people in the streets on their own volition. They couldn't just go, "You, I have power over you because of this thing." So additionally, the constables, who worked like a 9-to-5, in addition to that, most cities also had an institution called the Night Watch. Not like the cool kind who lived by the wall, but like a stranger kind. The Night Watch was a group of rotating volunteers who basically walked around at night with like a lantern and a big stick, and they made sure that no one stole stuff or set fires, and if something happened, they would ring an alarm. It was a pretty sort of innocuous group of people. Indeed, in the writings of the period, the most common complaint of them is that they're habitually drunk. It was like sort of, just walking around drinking, carrying a lantern or whatever. In the American South, however, there was another institution that predated and would be transformed into the police, and that's the slave patrol, also called alarm men or searchers. Excellent. This was a vigilante group of citizens who were hired by the plantations and supplied their own weapons. They were largely rural-based, but as they became more routine due to the increase in the number of slaves, they became loosely put under the control of local militia or courts. However, urbanization of southern cities consolidated the enslaved population in concentration in the cities and put people more close together than in the plantations, which of course made it easier to organize. So the threat of slave rebellion became more pronounced and more difficult to manage on behalf of the ruling class. So social controls like curfews and restriction on movement on black people, both free and enslaved, were implemented in order to try to hamper the organizing of these rebellions. And a new force was required to enforce this that was more permanent and centralized than the previous patrols. The justification for that can be seen in this quote from a Charlestonian from 1845 who described this change in language that's like very sort of perversely antiseptic. He said, "In the rural setting, the mere occasional riding about and general supervision of a patrol may be sufficient. But some more energetic and scrutinizing system is absolutely necessary in the cities, where from the very denseness of population and closely contiguous settlements, there must be need of a closer and more careful circumspection." So obviously all the violence is pulled out of that, but sort of the energetic scrutinizing system to deal with groups of people who are brought together who could rebel against the slave owners was something that was present to them. So these threats posed to the rich and powerful by strikes and rebellions in the North and insurrections or self-emancipations of enslaved blacks in the South required a new institution to meet the social conditions of crowds and struggle that were created by the growth of capitalism. So what was required, to quote Sidney Herring, was a full-time, permanent force capable of continuously asserting the power of the capitalist state up and down every street in every city. So they were assembled piecemeal through a process of trial error, and they took the constables and the night watch and the slave patrols in the South and fused them into a new professional standing body of armed individuals whose main job was two things. One, to patrol in order to police working class neighborhoods using the threat of armed force in order to maintain order and protect private property. And of course, they gave special surveillance and control for black people, both enslaved and free. And two, to manage crowds, to make sure that when people tried to protest, strike, or organize, they would break it down and quell dissent. So these two main functions, to patrol and to manage crowds, is pretty much unchanged in the history of policing. Up until now, with all the Comstat and all the fancy computer stuff they have, still the basic thing they carry out, what the majority of their energy and their money go to, is patrolling and managing crowds. For 200 years, that hasn't changed. So the new force was modeled on certain things, and it was modeled explicitly on techniques of colonialization and occupation. I already talked, of course, about the slave patrols, but the another branch of the family tree of policing goes back to the first modern police force, which was the London Metropolitan Police, which was created in 1829 by a guy named Robert Peel. That's where they got the name Bobbies for Robert. He developed his ideas for the new force, for the Metropolitan Police, from serving the British government and maintaining British colonial control of Ireland. So he was the person who was responsible for that. Peel found that uniformed soldiers of the British Army occupying Ireland were good at fighting wars, but not really equipped in maintaining order, as they often inflamed Irish resistance by firing on crowds, were expensive to maintain, and the visual of occupying troops was difficult for the colonized to stomach for obvious reasons. So he developed a different force to control the colonized folks of Ireland, the Royal Irish Constabulary, which is a more effective body for colonial domination. He used these ideas of managing colonization in the invention of the London Police. He said, this worked really well over in this place, let's use it on the city. And this relationship of police with occupation and colonization has been a reoccurring theme through the history of policing. It's not just at the origin. For example, in response to a massive wave of labor militancy after the Civil War, the U.S. state started creating state police. They said, oh, we need something else on top of this to control these labor rebellions. And the first state police was invented in 1902, and it was explicitly based on the Philippine Constabulary, which was the force that the U.S. government used to occupy the people of the Philippines. The most influential police textbook was written by a guy named August Vollmer, who's still considered a police reformer, who brought things that are now standard police practice, like fingerprinting and patrol cars. He was trained in the Philippines. So again, they train instead of bring it back over here. Even in the task force created by Obama in the wake of the height of the Black Lives Matter protest, the final report noted on their behalf that the primary problem of policing was that it was seen as, quote, an occupying force coming from outside to control the community. So for them, they see it as an image problem, from its origin, from then to Black Lives Matter. It's not just the image, but that's the reality of the police. This reality came into being when the Boston Police was established in 1838, the first in the United States. They sought to, quoting policymakers at the time, to imitate, as far as it may be, the system of London. So again, there's the thread from colonization to there. New York City followed with the creation of the Day and Night Police in 1844, and the modern police force in the United States was born. Its designed social function being repression and the maintenance of order in order to tamper down these chaotic conditions that are created by this dramatic increase in exploitation of labor that was occurring in the early days of capitalism. This anarchic drive towards increasing profit destabilized society that created these rebellions and social problems that police were invented to deal with. Marx points this out in Capital, in which he describes how the ruling class, quote, used the police to accelerate the accumulation of capital by increasing the degree of exploitation of labor. What this means by increasing the degree of exploitation is simply that you get, with less resistance, you get more work. And that was sort of the role of the police. The contradiction of capitalism, however, is that in order to get the most work and thus profits from people, it had to assemble them all in the same area and organize them into workplaces. But this is exactly what scares the capitalist, because now you have all the people who could sort of kick your ass both literally and revolutionarily all together in the same place with an interest in sort of fighting back. The police role is to manage this contradiction. They have to do this to get profits, but it creates this possibility of resistance. That's the contradiction that the police come in to try to sort of smooth out on behalf of the ruling class. So what about crime, though? So this is the repeated justification for the police. Despite what has been said, you know, from then until now, fighting crime has basically nothing to do with that, even by design. So in Boston, for example, which is where the first U.S. modern force was formed, crime went down from 1820 to 1830, so for the decade before the creation of the department. And in the city marshal report of 1824, crime was not even mentioned. So there wasn't sort of this concern of crime as it's conceived of now. Rather, it was the patrol function that then and now receives the most police resources, with the goal of regular police presence that's able to sort of like jump in and intervene and using the ever potential threat of violence. And it's important to note that it's not like violence per se, but it's the threat of violence that's really important. Because they walk around, they have their hand on the gun, and they use that as the backup for when they say, you know, move along, kid on the corner. People don't move just because they have some sort of authority. The authority is backed with the promise that they'll use violent force should there be any opposition to that. The first tool of the cop, of course, is the nightstick, the truncheon, a weapon that's used to force compliance and discipline crowds, not the magnifying glass or the fingerprint kit. So you have to understand that as well. Indeed, the role of detective, so the person that's supposed to go around and solve crime, didn't actually exist in the American Police Department for the first 50 to 75 years of its existence. So the concept of using it to solve crime wasn't something that was even in the heads of the originators of the force. But it was handy because it provided the justification. And so I think that means we must dispel the sort of the conventional mythology of the role of the police. Because since the beginnings of the institution, 200 years to now, still the main way that that someone catches someone who commits a crime is that someone who sees it goes and tells someone. Like, it's not the case that there's a lot of sort of gumshoe work going on. It doesn't take a giant body of swaggering guys with guns to go around and sort of make that to happen. The overwhelming majority of arrests are for minor drug offenses and so-called quality of life offenses. The majority of policemen make only one felony arrest per year, and most of the time they're spent on patrol. So this conception about sort of what they're doing is completely bunk. And the focus on sort of the quality of life offenses, you know, public drunkenness, vagrancy, public urination, unlicensed street vending, and other things, policing these small offenses aggressively is a common practice of what is called broken windows or order maintenance policing. In addition, police also are not a preventative measure for reducing crime. So there's no actually statistical correlation between the size of a police force per capita and the reduction of the crime rate. Indeed, it's often the case that places with higher per capita police forces sometimes have higher rates of crime. And so you see that with Chicago's murder rate as a sterling example. To prove this, there was an interesting study done last year in the journal Nature on the period of time when NYPD was throwing a temper tantrum because the mayor criticized them mildly for the murder of Eric Garner. So during this tantrum, they stopped carrying out necessary arrests for a short period of time. But I want to sort of note the very fact that they admit that there's unnecessary arrest they're not sort of carrying out, and then they admit that, should like make a bunch of alarm bells go off. And so during that time period of time, of course, the arrest rate of minor drug arrests and quality of life offenses plummeted, and nothing bad happened. Like, New York did not become some sort of chaos or sort of that movie that's playing now in which they talk about that sort of thing happening. But on top of that, so it wasn't just sort of the minor stuff, because people are like, oh great, you know, I'm not going to get a ticket for illegally parking. Society's not descending into chaos. But on top of that, the researchers found, and this is more interesting, that the reporting of major crimes, felony, robbery, murder, and assault, fell by half during the time of the slowdown. So to be clear, it's not the amount of major crimes investigated or reported by police, but it fell by the number of complaints the police received. So these things actually happen less. So cops are bad at solving crime, stopping crime, and preventing it. But I think that even with that as a sort of blowing out the balloon that they like to sort of carry over their heads, I think we should also take a step back and have a sort of critical approach to the concept of crime itself. The very nature of what is the target of enforcement and arrest is always skewed away from things that actually harm society. And I think this pulls back sort of the curtain and displays the true purpose of the police. Laws are not the framework upon which society operates, but law is the product product of how society operates. So it's for that very reason that vandalism and littering are policed while corporations pollute and poison the earth. How things carried out for survival, like theft, street trade, sex work, and the like, are heavily policed and thought of as crime, but the grotesque inequality that forces people to do stuff like that, to live, is not conceived of as criminal. This country is founded on theft and murder and slavery and genocide, and yet those crimes are largely unpunished, unresolved, and largely unacknowledged by the U.S. state as well. The main culprit of the miserable quality of life of most people in this country is because the system that produces millionaires and billionaires, but those offenses are celebrated and lionized by society as opposed to being punished. So this becomes especially true when you look at how crime is racialized. The war on drugs, of course, is primarily waged on black America, despite equal rates of drug use among whites and blacks. When the Cubs win, it's a rowdy celebration and boys will be boys, but when the people of Ferguson take the streets to protest police murder, it's a horrible riot. Laws are the product of class society and are designed to serve those at the top. So there's a quote from Engels in The Condition of the Working Class in England, where he says, "Certainly the law is sacred to the bourgeoisie, for it is of its own making, put through his approval and for his protection and benefit. He knows that even if a particular law may injure him as an individual, like sometimes they get caught with like drunk driving or stuff, still the complex of legislation as a whole protects his interests. He holds it to be holy, and the policeman's club, which is really his own club, holds a power for him that is wonderfully reassuring. But for the worker, it certainly does not. The worker knows only too well and from too long experience that the law is a rod that the bourgeoisie holds over his head." That's something that's important. The other dynamic of the myth of cops as crime fighters and how crime has been racialized, or rather, to quote Naomi Murakawa, how the problem of racism in society has been criminalized, is that after the destruction of chattel slavery, the myth of black criminality was then used as a justification for the construction of various apparatuses of repression in order to maintain control and restrict the freedom dreams of black America. So this was in the interest of the ruling class, precisely because the entire class order of the United States, of course, is based on that sort of racist oppression. And the interest is quite explicit for the connection on their side, but wanting to connect sort of black skin to criminality. The first sociological study that did that, that linked criminal behavior to black skin, was Frederick L. Hoffman's 1896 Race Traits and Tendencies of the Negro American. Hoffman was an employee of Prudential Insurance, and he created this study explicitly in order to allow Prudential to deny selling insurance to the newly free African-American population. That was the explicit purpose of the thing. The originators of the broken windows theory, George Kelling and James Wilson, blamed culture for crime in a way that is not so dissimilar from racist eugenicists like Charles Murray and Herbert Spencer. And so the connection of the notion of criminality to black people has been remarkably resilient and used every time which more police forces used out, from the Johnson's Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act to Nixon's law and order dog whistle politics, Reagan's war on drugs, Clinton's crime bill, and Trump's sort of gloom and doom tale about apocalyptic streets of Chicago. All this serves to justify the occupation of black communities by trigger-happy cops as an explanation also for poverty and inequality that especially affect black folks in this burning house of America. So back to the police. So when I sort of make these talks, it often comes up the question about sort of the extremes. Like, what about this one situation in which someone's having a mental health crisis, there's domestic violence, there's someone who's being really violent, what do we do about that? Don't we need someone who can intervene and keep force? Like, that's always the question that sort of people ask. I think that there's two things that I would say to that. Firstly, I think there's a litany of names that I could lay out. The cops have a horrible record of overreacting and making situations worse to the point of killing. Indeed, according to a study conducted by The Guardian, people who suffer from mental illness are 20% more likely to be murdered by a cop. The second point is that no expert actually trained to intervene in such situations think that police intervention is an appropriate one. No one thinks that. The very fact that most people are left with the only option of calling the police is due to situations which budgets have been cut to preserve the profits of the rich, and there's no other services for people to call, and so they call the police. And that's sort of what happens. Only the police remain. More mental health services would be the thing that would sort of solve that, and it's not a question of imagination. Like, people have all types of ideas about alternatives to police. We could have community response teams to deal with all these sorts of stuff. But it's not imagination, but it's the lack of power in the budget to carry out. It represents the warped funding priorities of the state and the ruling class, and not any kind of actual consideration about how to appropriately deal with social problems. It's actually absolutely absurd that the police are the lead agency in dealing with homelessness, mental illness, school discipline, youth unemployment, immigration, sex work, drug abuse, and more. Like, this is an absurd situation. You don't need to have like a 101 sociology degree to sort of understand that. On top of that, this cop intervention is always way more risky than whatever crisis situation they enter into. More than 3/4 of all homicides are done by someone the victim knows. So it's like most people who kill each other know each other. The random guy in the sort of the alley or the serial killer thing is a myth. But of all killings done by strangers in the country, a third are done by police. So that's for everybody. So if you're killed by someone you don't know, it's 1 in 3 chance that it's a cop. So cops are not only socially useless, but they're a social problem. I think we have to sort of understand it. Another myth that must be debunked is the idea that cop is dangerous work, like something that sort of people also sort of put forward too. The myth is continually used to justify the police and foster the image of the cop as hero who braves danger to keep the world safe, and that the killings that happen are just them making hard decisions in difficult situations. But according to the U.S. Department of Labor, being a cop is the 14th most dangerous job, with such jobs as fisherman, farmer, garbage collector, and taxi driver as way more dangerous. Being a cop is just barely more dangerous than being a maintenance worker and way less useful. This is important to note because again, the overwhelming majority of the times when cops shoot down black and brown people aren't instances of cops making difficult decisions in life or death situations. Alton Sterling was selling CDs. Philando Castile was pulled over for a traffic stop. Freddie Gray made eye contact, and that was all that was needed for a death sentence. Sandra Bland was driving. Eric Garner was selling cigarettes. Tamir Rice and Rakia Boyd were hanging out in parks. Michael Brown was walking the street. And Stephon Clark was in his own backyard. Like, these aren't examples of conflicts that the police had to intervene in. There was no wrong to any member of the community that had to be righted. Virtually all these killings are the result of, again, racially profiled routine stops, suspicion of drug possession or distribution, and so-called quality of life offenses. They're doing the very thing the patrol is supposed to do, which is to control and to terrorize. And so we don't need alternative methods for the cops to use in those circumstances. We just need them to stop. Like, I think we just sort of understand it in that sort of way. So, having discussed the historical origins and the social function of the police, I think the question too is how we get them to stop, because that's what we want to happen. Can we win them away from it? Is there any place in the struggle of the exploited and the oppressed for the police? Some people sort of argue that. I think the basic position that a socialist must make is expressed by this old guy, Leon Trotsky, who said, "The worker who became a policeman in the service of the capitalist state is a bourgeois cop, not a worker." Police should be seen not as allies of the working class movement, and our position towards the institution should be that of antagonism. We should see them as a separate social class. To make that argument, I want to say a little bit about their class position and how it reflects how their interests dramatically work contrary to working class interests, and show how that's demonstrated especially in their organization, that of so-called police unions. So as the Trotsky quote demonstrates, a majority of cops come from working class backgrounds. Like, that's true. The job itself certainly works for a wage, which meets the broadest definition of class, which sort of Marxists describe, and certain conditions of the job, you know, long hours, battles over overtime and the like, carry semblances of working class characteristics. They, of course, do not generate profit, as the function of the police is not to generate income for any private capitalists, or even the state, as most of the fees they collect don't match the exorbitant amount of money that the state uses to fund the police. However, workers like public school teachers and other professions that are connected with socially reproducing new workers also do not generate profit, and we consider them part of the working class. So I think we have to understand that class is not a thing, but a social relationship. It's one's relationship with the means of production, one's relationship with how society works, and also one's relationship with other workers. It's a relational aspect. The Marxist historian E.P. Thompson describes how class formation came into being when he says the working class, quote, came to feel an identity of interest as between themselves and as against the rulers and employers. Capitalism organized the world into categories with those people who own everything and those people who sort of don't. And there's a shared interest of those who don't to try to upset this world, and a shared interest of those who do own everything to sort of maintain the world. However, the social relationship means that there are some of those who work for a wage whose interests are different. There are individuals who have to work to survive, but their nature of their work is to act in the interest of the rulers and employers. So one example of this, but much more sort of subtle than that of the police, are like high-level managers and supervisors. So that's one example. While they don't own the corporations, they still work for the owning class, the entirety of their job is to manage and discipline workers. So they can be won over as individuals, perhaps, but as a class, their interests are aligned with the bosses. There's much written about by this by Marx about how this middle strata is unable to sort of come up with their own political sort of position, and because of that, they can move back and forth. But them as a class, I think, is something that doesn't have an independent position. They can be pulled in either way. Cops are an extreme example of this because their social relationship and their function solely as a repressive apparatus, their interests, again, not as individuals, but as a social strata, are never aligned with working class interest. And I say this as an extreme example because unlike managers and shopkeepers, they are more solid as a block in antagonism against workers. Like managers and these people don't go around and be like, we're managers, and they like have it on their t-shirt. But like if you're a cop, there's this like cop thing, like you're a cop and that's what you are. They consolidate themselves as a social class to justify and reproduce the repression. While manager's interaction is still to tell workers what to do, and he has the power to hire and fire based on what the bosses want him to do, the police does this sort of same thing, again, extremely exacerbated with the attitude of an occupier. He tells the workers what to do and has the power to fire his gun and kill if opposed. They have a material interest in enlarging and defending this primary apparatus of racist repression because it's their job. They want to sort of make their job better, and their job is repression, terrorism, and sort of control. This is a powerful social relation, and I think one that places their interests different from that of most working class people, all working class people. I think James Baldwin gets to this in his fantastic essay, Report from Occupied Country, when he writes, quote, "The police are the hired enemies of this population. They are quite stunningly ignorant, and since they know they are hated, they are always afraid. One cannot possibly arrive at a more surefire formula for cruelty." So this sort of consolidation of tools of repression, they have to sort of redouble that with them sort of being against everyone else, and it creates a social class that actually operates differently in against the interests of working class people, and especially black and brown people in this country. So there's much to said about sort of what class they are stuff. I don't want to get into it too much. You could do a whole talk about that. But I think it's an important grounding, and we can talk about it more in the discussion, about why they behave as a social block, and why they behave how they do, and why they're such a ruthless force of reaction. And so the behavior of their police associations, the Fraternal Order of Police and the Patrolman's Benevolent Association, reflect what I'm saying about how their collective interests are actually quite dramatically different than everybody else's. Because of this, while we defend unions generally, I think we should be opposed to cop organization and so-called cop unions unilaterally. Job security and protection for them is built on defending cops who brutalize other people and removing any kind of public accountability or oversight for behavior. More resources for them means more military-grade toys for them to use on black, brown, and poor communities, and they're quite explicit about this. On the FAQ site of the Border Police Union, they say why you need a union, they describe it as such. And it's kind of a long quote, but I'm going to sort of go through it because it's really interesting, and it's their words. "It was not unusual in the past for Border Patrol management to throw an agent to the wolves, to appease special interest groups such as the American Friends Service Committee, La Raza, or the California Rural Legal Assistance League. Many of these groups have deceiving names for a reason. all advocate open borders and or the return of California, known as Aztlan, to Mexico. They did their research. using whatever means necessary, including filing false allegations of abuse. They regularly make unsubstantiated allegations of civil rights abuses against agents in an attempt to slander and defame the U.S. Border Patrol. This places a heavy burden on management and administration officials who at times forfeit their personal integrity. So this is the official and primary reason for the union's existence, to help cops carry out migrant worker expulsion and to silence any protest of that. It's a class enemy by its own definition. This is the reason that why every time there's a murder of an innocent black person, it's the FOP representative who's the first person up there to not only defend the killer cop, but to slander the victim in the most grotesque racist manner. It's the reason why they act. It's a social reason that's not just culture, but it's produced materially by the role they play in the society. This is the reason why, if you look at every police contract, the point of the contract is to maintain them being able to defend themselves against allegations of abuse and to make it as difficult as possible for anyone to sort of report those allegations of their abuse. This is the reason why police unions around the country were solid supporters of the Trump campaign, and also why the Blue Lives Matter flag has become a fixture of the newly confident Nazi and white supremacist movement. Yeah. At least Nazis are honest when they admit that pro-cop means anti-black. Yeah. It's important to note there's no resistance to this. The culture of silence and solidarity within the cops' ranks profoundly ensure that there's no criticism. So again, this is a product of the social relationship of the class that I mentioned. And it's important because police culture, which liberals love to talk about, is not something you can sort of change, different from changing the material aspect of what they do in society. So there may be a minute handful of individuals who have spoken up about sort of police misconduct, who are cops, at great personal risk. But if you compare it with something like, say, the military, you see there's no comparison. So the question of the military, like soldier versus cop, is a whole discussion. We should take it up. I would say maybe not in this discussion because it's a whole sort of thing. But it's interesting just to note that during every major war, there's some kind of mass resistance by troops. During the American Civil War, soldier mutiny ended World War II, mass defections, GI resistance during Vietnam, Iraq veterans against the war in Iraq. Every time there's some kind of organized response. There's no analogous anything in regards to that for the police. Like there's never been any kind of movement that one can sort of acknowledge. Some point to the National Black Policemen's Association is the exception, and I think that actually doesn't stand as well. While certainly I think black officers face racism inside the force, it's also the case that the NBPA has made some statements about police killing during the Black Lives Matter movement, again, forced by protest. Stuff happened before and they weren't talking about it. But the statements are still lukewarm and superficial. In the same way that the social world of policemen align their interests against the working class, they align black cops against black folks. Studies actually find that black cops are as likely as white cops to commit abuse and murder. And black police chiefs have presided over departments in Chicago, Baltimore, Dallas with egregious records of murder and racism. And I can talk about Eddie Johnson, Chicago's guy, all day long if we want to. And I'm not even going to mention the Milwaukee guy, the Sheriff David Clark, who deserves special distinction for being a racist black cop. So the position of the NBPA is very well expressed by Black Deputy Police Chief Malik Aziz, who said the following thing. This quote is so telling. This guy's black, so I want to make sure you know. I can no more separate my black skin from the color of this uniform that I don every day for so many years. This is what we have to understand, even as black officers. Black people who shout to us, Black Lives Matter. You know what our response is to black people who shout to my black self that Black Lives Matter? Is yes, they do, and it's starting with me. What's your response to that? My life has to matter too. So there's some on the socialist left who have the unfortunate position that the police can be won to our side, that our demand should be to back police unions and workers and to argue for democratization of the police by those unions. I think that's the wrong position for the reasons that I've laid out, and hopefully what I've said sort of backs that up, that while they come from working class backgrounds, their social position as repressive apparatus and vanguard of racism creates a socially cohesive reactionary bloc. As I mentioned in Engels' quote earlier, earlier, the policeman's club is the club of the bourgeoisie. This is why police unions are so staunchly positioned on the right politically, and why no resistance within the police of significant scale has ever occurred. While there may have been a handful of times in which the police, largely under extreme pressure, have not come out to break strikes or whatever, they're by far the exceptions to the rule, and social pressure has occasionally, again, restricted some of their anti-working class elements, but never redirected it towards the ruling class. Our position is what Trotsky writes in Russian Revolution when he says that, quote, "The police are fierce, implacable, hated, and hating foes. To win them over is out of the question. Our slogan should not be cops join us, but no cops. And if I was speaking to an individual cop, I would say just stop being one. Like, sort of take off your uniform and go home." So how do we get the violence of the police to stop? By getting rid of the police. We must see the abolition of the police and prisons as the only solution. This flows from an understanding that is rooted again in their historical origins to the current role they play as being a tool of racist class rule. They secure the ruling class by being the monopoly on violence and force the ruling class has. This is they're allowed to be violent anytime they want, and how dare you question it? You raise a finger and they come at you. This use of constant threat of violence was used to quell protests and resistance, to protect private property, and occupy populations who are facing social crises due to the crisis of capitalism that has pushed poverty into these communities. The cops have no social use except as a repressive organization wielded by the ruling class. But fighting for ending police as a long-term goal doesn't mean that, of course, that we don't fight for reforms now. There are things that can be done to try to limit the amount of bad shit that cops do. However, the focus on abolition should shape what kind of reforms we advocate. I think this is really important. This means that we can fight for reforms to limit and constrain and hold the police accountable, but we should abandon the idea that we can reform the police. We can have reforms that can limit the violence, but you can't reform the police. That has to be sort of understood. The social function of the police is based on their violence and racism, protection of private property. This is inalterable. That's like saying that we're going to reform firefighters from fighting fires. Like, that just means to not make them firefighters. The same is with the police. For the same reason, I think reforms that say that more training is needed to make them nicer or culturally sensitive miss the boat and are also worthless. Similarly, we should reject the oft-repeated line that the problem of police misconduct is one of a crisis of trust between cops and black community. The problem is not communication or trust, but cops' violent behavior. And the thing, anytime you talk about, like, you know, community policing or training, you miss and you go down that line. So the reforms we fight for have to be aimed at trying to limit cops, to put a muzzle and a leash on their violence, and not attempt to transform a pig into a pony. That means that the reforms that we fight to have to first be about accountability. Cops facing consequences and justice for victims is an important first. Beyond that, any reform that can try to limit the number of cops, no more cops to be hired, getting them off of streets, getting them off of schools and campuses, reducing their budget, their access to weaponry, and anything that tries to place restrictions on their belligerent behavior. This is tied to broader fights, because you can't just say, just take those things away, because again, people call the police in situations in which someone's having a mental health crisis because of nothing else. We want to limit their violence as much as possible, but tie it to fights to adequately fund the resources that are needed to solve the social crises that cops are inserted into and that they inflame. So we need more teachers and social workers, not cops. We need to close prisons and open schools. We need more jobs and healthcare. And if politicians were actually concerned about so-called crime, that's where the money would go. But as I argued before, I think we should also interrogate the concept of crime. And so building a movement to challenge the police is an important component in building a movement also against racism. Our position is that of challenging the police means fighting for their total abolition. This fight strikes at the very heart of society because it means, again, removing their monopoly on violence. It means removing the main tool that they use to use violence, their main intervention on their side of the class struggle. And this is not going to be given up, again, by moral suasion or being convinced or like a well-worded policy proposal. Fighting for the abolition of police thus becomes connected with the struggle for power and control of the world we inhabit and the state and that maintains the status quo. Fighting against that also implies a struggle against capitalism and a fight for socialism. These tasks are intertwined, lofty and challenging, but I think in the end, essential for winning a world free of racism and police terror. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.